Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome to Now Where Were We? Bob Cryer here. This is part two of our trip to the pub with Stephen Fry. So, if you've not heard part one, you might want to listen to that first. But hey, do what you like. I'm not your mother. And as we dip back into the conversation, we're waxing lyrical about the genius that was Kenny Everett.
Kenny was a delightful man, and I suppose there will be young people listening who probably don't really remember him.
He called me Honorary Gay, friend of the family. I was delighted. And dear Terry and I had been married over 30 years by then, and Ev said to me one day, "Ooh, bah," he said, "you married over 30 years with four children. What a smokescreen."
I remember going, he took me to Heaven, the gay nightclub and disco, a huge, huge place, and absolutely not my thing at all. I mean, and but he said, "Oh, you'll have fun." And he was chatting away quite sweetly about his childhood in Liverpool when we were walking down the street. And then the moment he got through the door, he just, he, like an extraordinary flower, he just blossomed and became this figure who had to be the centre of attention.
Yeah.
And all the boys clustered round him and he was so happy.
Yeah.
But he wasn't really Kenny Everett. He was this invention,
that's right,
wasn't he?
We filmed at Heaven once and we finished and then there was some music playing. Ev and I were dancing together at Heaven, and he said, "Oh, they'll all be saying, who's that old man with Everett?" And I said, "No, they won't. They'll be saying, who's that dwarf with Barry Cryer?" Oh, it was a joy working.
Well, because he defied
him.
Labels, really,
yes.
Because he wasn't a comedian in the conventional sense, a DJ, a brilliant DJ, a great sort of inventive, creative mind. Not an actor, not a singer, but he was all these other things.
We had a charity sort of walk with people in wheelchairs and everything, Hatch End, where we live, and I was working with Ev, and bless him, I asked if he'd come and welcome them all back on the walk, and he said, "Oh, yes, yes." So he came to the pub and sat very quietly in a booth, chatting very quietly to me and the others. And then the gang arrived in the wheelchairs and everything, and he went out of the pub, "Hello!" and became Kenny Everett.
Yeah.
Morris Cole, wasn't
that's it? His name, yes.
The persona was Kenny Everett.
You said that about Keith Moon, too, when you were writing with Graham Chapman
Keith,
at the time.
Yes, Moon. Graham and Keith. And Keith would be mean to Graham sometimes.
We went to, always went to the pub, the Angel. Dear Graham, you know, by midday he'd be saying, "Ooh, just the one," and the day had gone, we'd be in the pub.
Well, he'd already met you at the door at 10 o'clock with a martini.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, quart of gin a day.
But we got
get through
a lot done on that morning. We had to. Yeah. Anyway, with Keith Moon, no less, we went to, there again, the persona. Keith Moon sitting chatting in the pub, and then he said to me, "Oh, I think they want a bit of mooning." He didn't mean dropping his trousers.
His ass, no.
And he got his lager, and he went bang with his lager on the floor. And they didn't evict him. Somebody said, "Behave yourself, Keith." And that was that. And as we left the pub, he leaned over to the bar and said, "How much do I owe you for the glass?"
Oh.
I thought, boy, Keith Moon said that.
That's the guy who supposedly drove cars into swimming
that's
pools
right.
And through televisions.
Oliver Reed, I arrived to do a chat show. You know this, Bob. And this man playing that drunk, that. And he wasn't. I mean, he was afterwards, bless him. But I was with him immediately before. He wasn't drunk at all.
Well, I heard that from people that worked with him. They said that there was never a problem when he was working. The problem was when he had 3 days off, didn't know what to do with himself. So sort of speaks to a mind that is restless and seeks maybe the, you know,
is
the,
it a
the,
cry
the
for
wrong.
Help if you do that on
well,
camera?
Part of it is also is that the rock stars of the 60s and 70s, like The Who and The Beatles more than any, like the great comedians of who made it in television in the 50s and 60s and 70s, had no generation to look back to for examples of the best way to use fame, because the only famous people in the past had been sports people and Hollywood stars who were hidden behind it. But suddenly there was this new thing. And people didn't know how to handle it. All this money, all this recognition.
Yes.
And, you know, there wasn't the example of their generation dying of drug overdoses and overdoing it and committing suicide and doing all the, you know, having all the horrors that this sudden attention can bring preparation. Whereas now rock stars are often considered dull because they know what the pitfalls are, because they know about John Bonham and Keith Moon and Janis Joplin. And that's true in comedy as well. I mean, if you look at that generation of the Carry On films and of people like Tony Hancock, these are desperately miserable people. I mean, I know it's a cliche of the tears of the clown, but they just had no idea how to cope.
Which is, I suppose, where that cliche comes from, the tears of a clown.
Yeah, and not
Kenneth Williams being
and not helped by the fact that there was no support system at all. There was no one ever thought about, you know, their mental health or the, you know, of how to cope with what was being thrown at them, and indeed how to protect them from being paid so little in the case of the Carry On stars.
Yeah,
it was really treated like servants, you know.
You used to say the same jokes in a different order.
Yes, that's right.
Hattie Jakes never opened the envelope, apparently, she said, when the script arrived. She did the line, I think. Same jokes in a different order. Oh, boy. No, the Goon Show was our Monty Python, because these men could have died. Peter Sellers was the youngest, wasn't he? He was sort of Enser entertaining, but Spike and Michael Bentine and Harry Secombe
did the real
And they
service.
Were injured,
yeah.
yes.
Yeah.
And they had no respect for authority by definition.
Yeah.
The government, the church, the BBC, and God, we used to gather around the radio. It was our show. We never heard a radio show like that.
No, because they'd seen the officer class and their incompetence.
That's right.
Up close. I mean, some of them were fine, but, you know, a lot of them really were chinless wonders or buffoons of one kind or another. And they fed into the characters he created for them, didn't they? I mean, the blood knocks and so on.
Oh, amazing.
So where do you think, if we're talking about these sort of totemic, these pillars crumbling now, and that we look in a landscape of storytelling, and we've spoken to Miriam Margolyes, who has now assumed indeed. Yeah. And she is telling stories from her life that she would say, I don't see them as funny, but they are honest and they are true. And that's why people laugh, because she has a great fear of the contrived comedy. She said, I don't like comedy that's meant to be funny.
And very often the great storytellers are not necessarily the greatest performers and artists. They are figures who are somehow connected and very often have a genius for friendship. So the great Hollywood raconteur that I was lucky enough to meet was Roddy McDowall, who was not a huge star. He was being a child star. He was in Lassie with, and National Velvet with Elizabeth Taylor. They were both sort of came over at the same age from Britain to Hollywood. And then he was in Planet of the Apes. But he knew everybody, and everybody adored him. And he told fantastic stories. And a British version of that, perhaps, was Victor Spinetti, who was a magnificent storyteller and, you know, not the biggest star in the world, but he worked with the Beatles, of course, and he worked with all kinds of actors. And he was delicious in his storytelling, wasn't he?
Yeah, he came to see me one night doing a show and then said afterwards, I resented paying for my ticket, he said. I'd heard all that in the pub from you, he said.
That's very good. He told me an extraordinary story about John Gielgud and Binky Beaumont. I mean, you've just got to say Binky Beaumont and you're in another world, aren't you? But Binky Beaumont used to run a company called H.M. Tennant, which owned and managed most of the West End theatres. And really, any play that was on in the West End was done by Binky. And he and John Gielgud had actually been lovers in the 30s, but they remained very good friends when they stopped being lovers. And Binky had a famous house, big country house, and he would have these weekends. And he called up Johnny Gielgud one midweek and said, can you come this weekend? And Gielgud said, oh, yes. And he asked if he could bring his friend. He had a boyfriend. And Binky said, of course, you'd be so welcome, all of you. And they arrived quite early because Gielgud had brought a brace of pheasants that he wanted to take into the kitchen and talk about the plucking of them with the cook, on whom he was in very good terms, which left this boy who'd come with him, alone on standing there, and Binky bustled forward to be the good host and said, well, Sebastian, it's lovely to meet you. Johnny says you're going to be an actor and that you're, you know, at drama school. That's terrific. I don't know if you're interested in country houses. We've got an orangery with a pineapple pit, which is quite rare. Would you like to see that? And anyway, he carried on like this. And then eventually all these guests arrived, you know, Orson Welles and Noel Coward and Olivier and all these huge figures. And Binky managed to find Johnny Gielgud and said, Johnny, your friend, you said he's going to be an actor. I don't think he's going to make it as an actor. Oh, why not? He's so awkward and peculiar. I mean, I talked to him and offered to show him things and said, Sebastian, would you like to see this? And he just made little circles with the point of his toe on the carpet and blushed. And Johnny said, oh, you didn't call him Sebastian, did you? And Binky said, well, I'm sure you told me that was his name. Oh, no, I didn't, did I? No, that's just the name we've given his cock. Isn't it fabulous?
Follow that. That's marvellous.
Well, actually, there's a Gore Vidal story, which I rather like, which is I was lucky enough to know him really quite well towards the last 10 years of his life. And he asked me, not long before he died, how the Savoy Hotel was. And I said, well, actually, it's closed at the moment. They're refurbing it. It had been closed for a year. He said, oh, my favourite hotel. And I said, why is that? And he said, well, it's literary reasons. I said, oh, well, because F. Scott Fitzgerald used to stay there and Oscar Wilde and people like that. He said, no. And he told me the story was he was in his suite one day and he said, I let my fingers do the walking, which was a reference to the Yellow Pages, if you remember. And I said, I found an agency, the Janus Agency or whatever it was called, the Stallion Agency, something. And I ordered a young man to come to my suite and... he arrived, and at some point I bade him turn over. And he said, no, I don't do that. And I said, we'll discuss it later. He said, well, it'll be an extra 30 quid. He said, well, just turn over. And anyway, the deed was done, and he lay back and had his necessary cigarette and then dressed and was ready to go, and I paid him his money. And he said, oi, where's the extra 30 quid? I said, I arranged the price with your people. I don't propose to deviate from him. And he started to cut up rough and threw an ashtray at my head. And so I pressed the bell that is very handily there next to the bedhead in the Savoy. And the man in the tailcoat and the striped trousers appeared at the door and bowed, Mr. Vidal, young sir. And I said, take this boy away. He's being a thoroughgoing nuisance. And the boy said, well, he did me up the arse and he's not paying the extra 30 quid. And the floor manager said, you come with me, young man. And so I thought no more of it. But then, when I was checking out, I received my bill and I couldn't but notice that at the bottom of the front page, it said, sundries, £30. That was the literary touch I admired.
Sundries.
Sundries.
Oh, boy. Use the language. Marvellous.
Gore was very good. Yeah. Just another quick Gore one was, as you know, he had a very long-running feud with Norman Mailer. They were two of the great novelists of the era. And in fact, Norman tried to punch him out on the Dick Cavett show once. And in his memoir, I think it was Palimpsest, one of his memoirs, he knew that Norman Mailer wouldn't buy the book, but he figured he'd go to a bookshop and look through it just to check. So in the index under Mailer Norman, it just said, hi, Norman.
I met Norman Mailer.
Did you? Now tell that story.
Yes, I wouldn't blame anybody for saying I don't believe this, but it's true. I came out of a lift, and if ever I bumped into anybody famous, I think, what doesn't threaten them? What's innocuous? I just say hello. And I came out, I thought, it's Norman Mailer. And I said, hello. Hello. I'm Norman Mailer. Who are you? And I said, my name's Barry Cryer. Sit down, Barry, I'm bored. The guy he had to meet hadn't turned up. And I chatted away to Norman Mailer. End of that great story.
Well, it is a good story. And it reminds me, while we're on the Savoy, I will tell you my story. It was, I, for very complicated reasons, there was a period where I lived at the Savoy Hotel in 1989 or 90, I think it was. I was suite-sitting for an American friend who had gone back to America for personal reasons and didn't want the suite emptied of his personal effects. And so he said I could stay there for 3 months while he was away, and all I'd pay was the room service. So I had, you know, it was really good fun. And you get to know the staff. And Ernesto, I think his name was, who was one of the link men, the one in the tall hats, who, you know, doormen, we would call them probably, but they call them link men in the world of hotels. He said to me one day, he said, tell me, are you a fan of Frank Sinatra? And I said, you bet I am. I absolutely worship Frank Sinatra. He said, oh, he's coming to stay. He'll be here next week for a few nights. I thought, wow, maybe I'll bump into him in the corridor or whatever. Anyway, I was filming. I was doing this film, Peter's Friends, at the time. And so it was really exciting to get the car picking me up from the Savoy and dropping me there. And I was able to really cock a snook at my friends in the movie who were thinking, what is he doing? Anyway, we had a late night's filming, and I got back at about midnight or 1 o'clock, and Ernesto was on the door. He said, you come with me. And he took me over, you know, the little steps that go down to the American bar, which there was a rope in front of them, yeah. And it was closed. And he said, step over. And I went in, and there, sitting at a table in a pool of light with a cigarette and a glass of whiskey, was Frank Sinatra. And Ernesto said, Mr. Sinatra, this is Mr. Stephen Fry, one of our promising young actors and comedians, and I thought you two would get on very well. So Sinatra said words I will never forget to me. He said, sit down, kid. He called me kid. I was so thrilled. So I sat down and just sort of opened my mouth to speak, really, and we'd hardly had a conversation when about 30 friends of his came in, and that's why he was there. And I didn't exactly get pushed to one side, but they all knew him well, and they were all clapping him on the shoulder and things like that. But it was pretty good. Now, it has two parts, this story. So that was meeting him, which was thrilling, even if it was short. But then about 3 days later, I said to Ernesto, I said, is Frank still staying? He said, no, he left this morning, as a matter of fact. Quite a funny story. I said, what's that? He said, well, he said, as he was about to get in the car, he shook my hand and said, thank you, Ernesto. And he brought out this thick roll of money, these 10 and 20 pound notes, and he pressed it into my hand. Said, thanks for a great stay. I said, that is very kind of you, Mr. Sinatra. Thank you very much indeed. And he said, tell me, is that the biggest tip you've ever received? And I said, no, sir. As a matter of fact, it isn't. And he was most put out. He said, well, who gave you a bigger one? I said, you did, sir, last time you stayed. Isn't that brilliant?
Yeah.
They are very cunning, these people. And, of course, Frank Sinatra would go off feeling fabulous, yeah. And next time would probably give him an bigger tip.
Oh, boy.
That's fantastic. Well, you had that with Groucho Marx. Not that he called you kid, but you got to meet the great man.
Oh, wow. Yes. Benny Hill had made it big in America, and they were trying to launch Des O'Connor. We were working on a series at L Street with Des. And Marty Feldman was doing the Marty Feldman comedy machine at the same time. And the great Marx was going to appear on it. We couldn't believe it. And I'd become friends with Brian, American writer who was working on the show, became a director. Anyway, this guy and I become friends. Even in those days, people were going about with bottles of water, but we were the two rollers in the bar. And I had the book, The Groucho Letters, he'd written to amazing people like T.S. Eliot.
T.S. Eliot, famously, yes.
So I brought it in, and Brian, my American friend, said, what? I said, well, if there's a moment, the great man might sign the book for me. And the next day, I'd still got the book with me. He said, look over there. And it was Larry Gelbart, the producer, sitting with Groucho Marx, having lunch, whatever, and Groucho with a real moustache and a berry on. And give me your book. I said, he's having his lunch. And he went over to the table, and Groucho obviously looked back across at me, what is all this, right? And signed the book. And Brian brought it back to me, and he said, what did he put? I didn't look. He said, he's just put from Groucho. Don't you want it personalized? And he went back a second time, and I'm now hiding behind a pillar. And then he insulted him by saying, put Marx after Groucho. This story
so doesn't get confused. Groucho so, Spencer.
I have got the evidence at home. Groucho Marx, by now, so really irritated and annoyed, initially put Marx in the wrong place. And I've got a book to Barry Marx. That was a bizarre day there.
That's fabulous.
And then I met him in reception and we were sitting there and he says, where's my car? Don't they know I haven't got long for this world? Then he looked at me and he said, do you swim? Out of the blue, do you swim? I said, yes, I like swimming. Yeah, I got a pool. I don't swim in it. Why not? They found a friend of mine floating in his.
Strange.
And his daughter, Barbara,
that's right. Yeah.
Wanted to join a club which had an anti-Semitic reputation. And she was turned down when she applied for membership of the club. So Groucho wrote to the club saying, for your information, my daughter is half Jewish. Can she go in the pool up to her waist?
Oh, that's brilliant. It's an extraordinary thing, that idea that America, the land of the free, had such open racism in things like that. It was not considered odd to have a club where you banned people of a certain ethnicity. And I am Jewish in as much as my mother's Jewish. So I have American cousins. And one of them was said to me very proudly, I've just joined the country club in Seattle. I'm the first Jew to join. I said, but why would you join a club that has such a terrible history? And he said, well, it's great to be a member. And I said, well, I suppose that kind of makes sense. Boy. But there was a Woody Allen sketch, one of his most famous monologues, which was about the Solomons and the moose. Do you remember
that
one?
Oh,
boy.
Yeah.
And there's a hunting thing, and Mr. Solomon gets shot instead of the moose and is put onto the bonnet of the car. And is tied there where you'd normally have the head of a moose. There's Mr. Solomon's. And it's all very surreal and weird.
Yeah.
But it ended with this thing about, and then it was taken and put onto the wall of the New York Athletic Club, where it hangs to this day. But the joke's on the Solomon's because the New York Athletic Club is restricted. And I never knew what that meant, restricted. And it had to be explained to me.
Restricted.
It didn't allow Jews. So he got in. I mean, that is so extraordinary, isn't it? Sick. And of course, you talk about Larry Gelbart, and he was one of that extraordinary generation of Sid Caesar writers, wasn't
That's
he?
That's right.
Along with Mel Brooks and Woody Allen. And
Talking about the Frost Assembly of British writers in the 60s, that was the same.
Yeah,
kind of thing,
it was a real nursery of
amazing
extraordinary talent.
That,
And Sid Caesar is probably the least remembered of all.
Yes.
And it was his show.
He was the man writing for. I was, working on his show at Elstree, and Dom DeLuise, I'd met and got to know, had worked with everybody.
A favourite of
Mel
Brooks's.
And we were just hanging about one afternoon, I think, in a dressing room. Well, whatever. Mel Brooks and Anne Bancroft walked in. I couldn't believe it. And Dom, bless him, said to Mel Brooks, Mel, this is Barry Cryer. Mel Brooks said, never mind. I don't know why that's...
It's just a
wonderful.
Nice...
Never mind.
Wonderful.
Ross Noble did Young Frankenstein here, and Mel Brooks came over. I think it was a woman director, but she was shadowed by Mel Brooks all the time at rehearsal, the great man. And
it was Susan Stroman, I think, directed it.
Yes. And Ross said, we opened in Newcastle, his hometown, and he said, I'm sitting with the great Brooks in a corner. Mel Brooks has got a jockey cap on and dark glasses, sitting in a corner with Ross Noble. And he said, a man came in the restaurant and spotted me and went, Ross Noble! And Mel Brooks stood up and went, hi!
Betty did. He said such a touching thing to me. It was just a great human truth. It's not a joke, really. And yet somehow he managed to make it funny in that wonderfully borscht belt sort of way, because his wife, his beloved wife, Anne Bancroft, died.
Yeah.
And this was about 5 or 6, 10 years after she died. I said something that referred to Anne Bancroft. And he said, do you want to know the kicker, the real killer? I said, well, they said, I miss my wife every day, but what really drives me crazy, her mother is still alive. And it was true. Dan Bancroft's mother lived to 105 or something, and it drove poor Mel crazy.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And there's a place in Beverly Hills called Nate and Al's, a diner, a kind of Jewish delicatessen diner, where Larry King has breakfast every morning. And if you go in there, you can see Larry King at one booth. And then you used to see Mel and Carl Reiner and the other, these extraordinary. And a guy called George Schlatter, do you remember him?
Oh, God, yeah, yes.
He was a producer who was a friend of Sinatra's and produced Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In and shows like that. And they would all sit there recalling the old days. And I remember thinking it's probably what kept them so alive and so energized.
Yeah.
They just loved insulting each other, telling stories, just keeping the old juices flowing.
Yes.
And maybe that's a part of stories too, is that it keeps alive the people who would otherwise be dead because you tell stories about them and that keeps them alive. But it also keeps the storyteller alive for just, you know, somehow it cheers you up and reminds you.
Think about being rude to old friends as well.
Yeah.
I'm never rude to people I don't like. I can't be bothered.
No, that's
but
right.
But you see people overhearing you in the pub or so one day to think, what?
The best compliment.
Did you hear what he said? Yeah. It's so true. You insult each other joyfully. It's great.
Yes, it's like in academia, it always amuses me that, you know, you'll be crossing an ancient cloister at some college and you will hear people disagreeing about something like whether gnaw packet soup is better than Maggi. If you think that,
yes,
you are a moron, a blithering idiot. You have no right not only to a position in academia, you have no right at all to vote. You're absurdly stupid. And that's a minor disagreement. But if there is a serious disagreement,
yes,
it would be always, well, there are certain points on which we have to diverge. You know, and you know that's when they hate each other.
I did pantomime in Cambridge, and I was sitting in a restaurant, I think it was, and I actually overheard a woman say to the man she was with, "Has Simon noticed there isn't a main verb in that sentence?"
And we're back to Alan Bennett.
Yes. Yes. Oh, do you know Alan Bennett swears that he saw in a newspaper, you know, in the back of newspapers, local newspapers in particular, they used to have the in memoriam section.
Oh, yes.
And there would be little verses and things in them. And he swears he saw this verse in the back of a newspaper in Leeds that said, "Along the lanes of memory, the lights are never dim. So long as stars in heaven shine, we shall remember her." And as he said, they probably did it, you know, they did it for Uncle Stanley. And so when Auntie Vi died, we'll do that verse again.
And send.
Yes, exactly.
Alan Simpson at Dennis Vane Wilson's funeral.
Oh.
You know that one?
No, go on. I'd love to know it.
It'd be great. Dennis Maynard.
Dennis produced the very first television I ever did.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
And he did Hancock.
And Steptoe. Yeah. And
well, it's St. Paul's Covent Garden, now a church, as you well know.
Yeah.
And Dennis had gone, so we all, oh boy, yes, good. And Big Alan stood up to speak. And we thought, this is going to be dry and funny. No. It's by the Reverend somebody, that corny old thing, I'm not gone, I'm just round the corner, laugh as you always did. So he did this, you could hear a pin drop. We thought, oh, respect. And he finished it. And he turned to the coffin and he said, I told you, Dad, not a fucking laugh in it.
God, he was extraordinary. Yeah, we Hugh Laurie and Emma Thompson and I and Tony Statry and the others, we'd done this review at university and it had won this new prize that was available at Edinburgh called the Perrier Award. It was the first year of it, and
yeah,
very excited, but even more excited, really, when Dennis Mayne Wilson appeared at the stage door and said, I'm over for the BBC and I'd like very much to do your programme on BBC Two. I can get a budget and we'll show it. And we were like, wow. And then I remember telling my father, and my father said, did you say Dennis Mayne Wilson? And I said, yes. He said, that name is in my head because any one of my generation, you listen to the radio and you heard, and the producer, Dennis Mayne Wilson.
It's just, yes.
He said, it must be the same man. And so, of course, I got to know him. And he was a bit of a drinker. And he always had a senior service cigarette, you know, untipped on the go, and a whiskey in his hand, usually chasing a pint. And that would start at 10:30 when the bar opened. And so we soon discovered the only way to have a meeting with Dennis was to say, we'll be in the office at 9 o'clock. Oh, come at 11. Unfortunately, it has to be 9, you know, because it's the only time he'd be coherent.
Well, we're only a stone's throw away from the Yorkshire Grey.
Yes, the pub,
broadcasting house. It was known as YG1. Where is so-and-so? They're in studio YG1.
A lovely guy called Kenny Earle. Who'd been in a double act, Earl and Vaughan. He became an agent and equity and everything. And dear Kenny went and they asked me to speak. And the atmosphere was just delightful. His two daughters said, our memory of Dad is laughing and everything. And it must have been back in my head somewhere, unconsciously, about Alan Simpson at Dennis Mayne Wilson's funeral. Because Kenny was there in the coffin and I stood up to speak. And I spoke for about a minute, and then I turned to the coffin and said, shut up, I'm talking. And at that moment, I thought, what am I doing?
Oh, no.
But they laughed, and it was all right. But, oh, boy, those moments.
I suppose memorials provide the greatest opportunity for the, you know, defining anecdote about someone's life.
Mitch Murray, Bob Monkhouse's funeral was at Amersham, and an enormous turnout of people. And the usual courtesy, the family party go in first. And Mitch didn't mean to. He got caught up in this family party going in. And the man came up with a list and said, excuse me, are you on the list? And Mitch said, I certainly am. I'm one of the people being cremated this afternoon. I love all this.
Oh, it's very important. Yeah, there are not many comics who would expect only solemnity.
No, there's nothing wrong with laughing at a funeral. No. If your memory of the person is
that was your experience with Graham Chapman, wasn't it? Chapman's funeral.
Yeah.
And John Cleese.
Yeah, that was astounding, wasn't it? Oh, astounding.
Oh, marvellous.
But I think there is a problem in Britain, and often that people will say that if you laugh with something or about something, it means you also disrespect it. I remember Tony Slattery used to do a perfectly brilliant impression of Douglas Bader walking, and it was very, very funny. And he did it on something we did on television, and I was invited, because I think I'd co-produced it or something, to go on one of those either Channel 4 programmes or it was a BBC 2 programme, the one with Ludovic Kennedy, or one of those things where you have to answer to a member of the public who has a complaint. And this person said, do you know what Douglas Bader went through? I said, yes, because I read Reach for the Sky by Paul Brickhill 4 times when I was a schoolboy. I worship that man. Don't you understand? You can find someone's walk funny and think they were an extraordinary hero. The two don't cancel each other out.
Yeah.
You're not saying I devalue Douglas Bader by doing his walk.
Well, that's like, Cleese and Jones with Malcolm Muggeridge and the Bishop of...
Southwark.
He was Southwark.
Mervyn Stockwood. Yeah, that was extraordinary, wasn't it? Tim Rice was the presenter. he got the poison chalice for that show, didn't he? But it was it's still worth looking at that because it was a defining moment in some ways about comedy and trying to understand irony. My friend Christopher Hitchens, a great man, I think, he always said that in a way the best division you can ever make in the world is between literalists and ironists. And there are literalists who don't understand fiction and irony and characterization and just don't understand metaphor almost. And they're too, you know, and comedy relies on people to understand that you don't necessarily mean what you're saying. You're using it as a way of tickling it. You're tickling the sensitive parts of society. No comedian, unless they're absolutely pathological, is going to use the F and the C word if they're entertaining a group of old ladies and similarly, you wear a suit for the occasion where a suit is, or even a dinner jacket if it's that kind of occasion. And your verbal language is the same. You when you're with your friends, you say things you would never say to old ladies or old gentlemen. And it's about a kind of sensitivity that most decent people have. And to try and make it an extreme case of, oh, that's just wokery, or an extreme case of, oh, that's just bigotry, is such a shame.
That doesn't inform any discussion at all, does it, on either side?
And it doesn't recognise the reality of things. And the genius of comedy is it recognises the reality of things. People make grand statements and a comedian says, yes, but can you get your trousers dry cleaned on a Sunday? You know, because you're in the real world all the time.
Because it has an involuntary reaction.
Yeah, and the real world is the what you test people's hypocrisy and stupidity against, what you see us all doing when we're down in the mud of life.
Well, one of the things, and this is sort of tying in the US tradition and British tradition that I've never squared, which is roast culture.
I'm not a fan of
that. Yeah, and it works seemingly brilliantly in the States. Mm. And here's a country, Britain, who thrives on satire and sarcasm and irony and all these things. And the roast seems to miss a beat when it comes over here, doesn't it? And
I
sort of
work.
Quite worked out.
It doesn't work
why.
At all, no. And I've been to that place, the Friars Club in New York. I'm sure you've been there, where they tend to hold these things. And one of my closest friends is Tita Khan, who's the widow of Sammy Khan, the lyricist, who used to write fabulously rude versions of lyrics for roasts, for Sinatra's roast, because he and many composers wrote some of the great songs for Sinatra. So they're all very, and you look at the lyrics and they're brilliantly witty, the way he could make them very rude. But then you watch the actual roast itself and the speeches, and you just are horrified by it. It's just because it's without any irony.
Yeah, that's the thing.
It's just sheer insult.
They tried it here. I did one where it was Bruce Forsyth, who I'd worked with a lot from the Windmill days and Generation Game and everything. And the audience were just uneasy throughout. Yeah. When he did Strictly Come Dancing, they said in the warm-up he was brilliant with working off the audience and all that, but he had to read alter cue at certain moments in Strictly. And I said to him on the show, I said, watching your face when you were reading alter cue, I hadn't seen anything like that since I hypnotised our cat. And the audience would go, oh, that's rude. You know what I mean? And so it doesn't work here, the roast.
No.
I was roasted, thanks to you, wasn't I?
Yeah, and it was that same thing of, well, here's cuddly Barry Cryer that everyone loves, and he's an uncle, you know, to all these comedians
the
who've come on.
The atmosphere was better on that.
Arthur Smith didn't struggle to insult you, but that's part of Arthur's weaponry. Yeah. So it was sort of expected. Stephen K. Amos came on, and bless him, he sort of got halfway through and said, I can't say this stuff to your face. It doesn't seem right. And the audience agreed. And I think we all agreed. We said what I took from that is something you've always said about working lines out before you go in front of an audience. Said, if the musicians, if you've got a band, laugh, or if the camera crew are laughing, I won't put that in front of an audience, because there's a complicity to that sort of laughter, which is very different to the kind of laughter you get from an audience.
Yeah.
Talking about rewriting lyrics at the Friars Club, you used to rewrite Noel Coward lyrics, and it takes us back to Cabaret and it takes us back to the beginning.
Shameless. I'd never have got
crowbarring
away with it. Never have got away with it in the theatre across the Lord Chamberlain, but at Danny LaRue's Club, I would shamelessly take a song from a hit show and just rip off the tune and write a new lyric. And Lionel Bart had a show called Blitz, and there was a song, Who's This Geezer Hitler? And I had wittily written for Ronnie Corbett and Danny Roo, them as Caesar and Cleopatra, and wrote this song, Who's This Geezer Caesar?
Nice. Nice.
And one night they said, Lionel Bart's in. I went, oh, God. But he saw me. Hello, Bell. He said, who's this geezer Caesar? Better than mine. Isn't that lovely? Just
that
comes
is so
to
sweet.
So anyway, we did a Noel Coward finale arranged by a guy called Bill Solly. It was brilliant. But the great man sat there at the front table smoking his Marlboro, and you're doing a Noel Coward finale. It was nerve-wracking. Oh, anyway. He came in the very crowded dressing room. We were all crammed into the same dressing room. And he sat on the table with his legs dangling. He stayed quite a while. And he said, the finale, who did the finale? And we said, Bill Sully, brilliant, brilliant. And he chatted away, it's lovely. And I thought, oh, unsettling. Because at the beginning of the show, I'd ripped him off. He did a show called Ace of Clubs with a song, we're two juvenile delinquents, da 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 da. And I ripped it off. Tony Palmer and Danny LaRue sang, we're two most successful call girls, we're the toast of all girls who were on the game, subtle stuff. So I thought, oh dear, dear, oh dear, hope he doesn't mention it. Who did the song at the beginning? I said, sorry, that was me. And he patted me on the head. He said, nearly as good as mine.
Oh,
they used to come and enjoy it. It was marvellous at the club. You'd be taking the, you know how to
do.
Ronnie Corbett and Danny played Margot Fonteyn and Nureyev. One night, Margot Fonteyn came in. I thought, oh, my God, I'm hiding in the dressing room. She laughed all the way through.
That's amazing.
And as a result, she booked the club on private night, which she didn't usually do. She and Nureyev, her husband in a wheelchair, had been shot.
Oh, yes,
in
the Panamanian.
The Australian Ballet Company. And Doug Fisher, we had in the show, who Danny had spotted at Oxford, not Cambridge, actually. Mm-hmm. Doug spoke Russian. So I said to Doug, you introduce it on Tuesday night. So he went on and did pure filth in Russian, Nureyev pissing himself laughing. They were laughing at Nureyev laughing. Then Ronnie Corbett came on. They were laughing at Ronnie Corbett. But the man next to Nureyev was going, translating what Ronnie Corbett was saying. I was getting three laughs for every joke.
That's
that was a wonderful night, but I never forgot that woman laughing.
Yeah.
Sometimes they don't like it. There is a story of Peter Cook, if you remember, in Beyond the Fringe, there was a sketch called Supermac in which Peter imitated Macmillan, the Prime Minister, which sounds like nothing now, but was very, very rare and racy in those days. And so they were performing here in London at the Fortune Theatre, I think it was, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And someone noticed that Harold Macmillan was in the front row, or the second row, was, you know, close in there. And they said to Peter, what are you going to do? He said, well, I'll do the monologue as I do. And it was, he did this very sort of Harold Macmillan voice, and there's some good jokes in it about, I see Britain's role in the new age as that of an honest broker. Let's face it, no nation is more honest, and certainly no nation is broker. And, a few good jokes like that. And then he says, I have a marvellous relationship with a young, sappy, vibrant president, Mr. Kennedy. And if I have it, and this is where Peter went off script. And if I have some spare time of an evening, I like to toddle along to the theatre where there are vibrant and amusing, irreverent young comedians making fun of me, and I sit and look up at them with a frozen smile all over my silly old face.
Yeah,
and then the smile disappeared and there was a chill in the theatre, and Alan Bennett said, he's gotten too far this time.
That was great.
Wow.
Do you have a coward memory or a story that...
Well, I'm a vice president, yes, as it happens, of the Noel Coward Society. So, you know, I know a lot of stories. Some of them are thoroughly indecent, of course. I'll tell you just for your own amusement. It's just such an unlikely figure as well for him to hit on. It was the young Kenneth Moore, the actor, was introduced to him. And at some point, Noel just sort of took him and said, tell me, Kenneth, isn't it? And he said, yes, yes, Mr. Coward. Said, tell me, Kenneth, do you take it up the arse? And Kenneth Moore said, well, as a matter of fact, no, I don't. Oh, very well, we needn't quarrel about it. But, you know, there was some very sweet ones. I like it when he was stepping off the plane in Kansas City, and the journalist from the Kansas City Star sort of came up to him with a notebook or a microphone and said, do you have anything to say to the Star, Mr. Coward? And he said, twinkle. Just very nice and simple. But he was an extraordinary man. He had a genius for friendship as well. I mean, his piano and his shelves were covered in silver-framed photographs of people he worked with, whom he adored, and his whole family was the theatre. It was what he loved more than anything in the world.
Yeah.
And if you took him out of that, he was nothing, and he could be quite miserable. I remember Michael Attenborough of the Attenborough family was a godson of Noel Coward's, and when it was Coward's 70th birthday, always very easy to remember when his birthdays were, because he was like the Queen Mother, born in 1900. So it was in 1970 at the Savoy Theatre. There was this show for him, and I think it's when he got his knighthood as well, possibly, and things like, or maybe he'd had that earlier. And Michael was very nervous of him, and he got a £5 note in his birthday card every year, but he didn't really know him, but he called him Uncle Noel, and so he sort of tapped him on the shoulder because he was sitting behind him, and Coward looked round rather crossly, and Michael said, it's Michael. Oh, of course. Hello. He said, how are you, Uncle Noel? And he looked at him for what seemed to be 20 seconds and said, dying. That was it. Oh. So he could be quite... I mean, what do you say to that?
No.
It's not a generous thing to say.
No.
It wasn't just the finale. He used to come to Danish Club several times, and we heard one night he was cornered by a guy in the club who'd had a few, who said to Noel Coward, I passed your house last night. And he said, thank you. Oh, and they said... story, they were having a tea break or something, rehearsal of his play, and one of the actors was giving his nose a very enthusiastic pick. And Noel said, give me a wave when you get to the bridge.
Gorgeous. And you know.
And Michael Redgrave, the sea shall not have them.
Oh, no.
The poster. Yeah. He was walking past the poster of The Sea Shall Not Have Him, and Michael Redgrave is in it. And I can't remember who else, but Noel Coward said, I don't see why not, everyone else has.
Yes, exactly.
Oh, and there's a curse on doing Gone with the Wind as a musical, and it was done in the 70s, and it was done subsequently. It never seems to work, and it was very elaborate. It had a revolving stage and flood and lighting and... God knows what, a horse on the stage.
Yeah, the Burning of Atlanta, presumably.
Yes, that's right. And Bonnie Langford was the girl and everything. And Noel went with some friends the opening night, and it was reported a lot. It was a disaster. Revolving stage stuck, the horse obliged all over the stage, the lighting went off and everything. And they're walking out, and somebody said, what did you think, Noel? I think the two main problems could have been solved by sticking the little girl up the horse's arse.
Ow!
And to her credit, to this day, she tells that story. She told it on the one show.
Very sporting.
Bonnie Langford, yeah.
Just like Dolly Parton's got the gift of getting your defence in early.
But yes.
Yeah.
Well, we've come to the end of our time together, I'm sad to say. And as I struggled for labels at the top of the show, I want to end with a rather charming one, which you may recognise, which is a man who is described as autocratic, angry and self-willed. He was also magnanimous, extravagant, generous, elegant, brilliant, and fun. And my favourite bit, he was probably the most variously gifted Englishman of any age.
Wow. That's a great description.
If I told you that was said by John Arlott, that was C.B. Fry.
My all too distant kinsman, yes, who was one of the most extraordinary natural athletes that this country ever produced. That there is a well-attested story, which sounds quite incredible, but he could stand in front of a fireplace and jump backwards onto the mantelpiece and keep his balance there. He had the world long jump record for 17 years, as well as captaining England and playing in an FA Cup final. He captained England in the golden age of cricket. He was extraordinary. And they say he was offered the throne of Albania. It's a strange idea. He wrote his autobiography, A Life Worth Living, which is an extraordinary list of his achievements. Apart from anything else, he came out first in the Oxford class list as well. He had the better degree than F.E. Smith, who became Lord Chancellor and others. But his great friend was Prince Ranjit Singh, who was the cricketer who invented the leg glide famously, and was a prince of India, and played for England, because that was how weird cricket was in those days. And through his princedom at some point, he was a member of the League of Nations. He was a senior figure in the League of Nations, the forerunner of the United Nations. And when King Zog fled Albania in the 1930s, or maybe actually probably the late 20s, there was a vacancy at the throne. And Prince Ranjit Singh said, I don't know of anybody who could fill that vacancy better than my friend C.B. Fry. Because all those descriptions that John Arlott gave of him,
that's right,
would actually suit you perfectly for that kind of
leadership. But our Norman Wisdom wasn't ready yet.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. But wouldn't that have been marvellous?
Yeah.
Known affectionately as C.B. wasn't he?
The whole channel for children named after him.
But that genius for friendship, or the gift that you talk about, is the common thread. And that's what a lovely thought to end on.
Thank you.
To nurture that is to, you know, to tell great stories and remember people with fondness.
Same time tomorrow.
Beautifully wrapped up. Beautifully done. I've enjoyed myself so much. I always enjoy myself in talking to the great Barry Cryer.
Thank you, Steve, very much.
I know he hates being complimented. Yeah. Don't blow smoke up my ass.
Don't praise me. I become unbearable.
Well, that's it from me, Dad, and Stephen Fry. And if you enjoyed this, then do please leave us a review and subscribe. It really does make a difference to us. We'll be back in the pub on New Year's Eve with Danny Baker. Now, I'm going to confess, I'm just a little bit worried that Danny and Dad might not have much to say to each other. So until then, I'm Bob Cryer. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.